Okay, very good. Okay, welcome everyone. I'll invite everyone, first of all, to turn off your cell phones. And anyone who's towards the back, please, there's a lot of great seats right here. You're not intruding on anyone's space. You have a nice table you can take notes on. It's a good place to be. My name is Ethan Tucker. Welcome to our fall Machon Hadar lecture series. Very excited to be starting that up again this year. And before we even begin the topic tonight, I want to, first of all, as kind of this first public moment of welcome, welcome the 22 full-time Yeshivat Hadar fellows who are here anchoring this Beit Midrash for the year and making possible really this being a Mekom Torah for the broader community. So we salute all of you and are really glad to have you be in touch with the larger community as well. Good. So with that, there are source sheets that ideally you should have received when you came in downstairs. If you did not, who does not have a source sheet? Okay, we got one over here. There's a couple other copies that are coming up. So for now, share with the person next to you. But there are more on their way. All right, so in doing this series, I had two fundamental reactions given to me. One was, I have been waiting for years for someone to do a session on this topic that would really deal with it in depth and be open and non-apologetic and not overly critical and strike the right balance. And then, I'll leave it to you to figure out the proportions, why in God's name are you doing this topic? So I want to say a word for those of you who don't fall into the first camp about why it is I'm doing this topic, and I think it's important that we'll be studying it together, and some of my own hopes of what we might accomplish. The first is that the privacy of this topic, and in my humble opinion, the lack of honest public discourse about it, sows a great deal of confusion, pain, disagreement, and any number of other descriptions we could come up with, between people who deal with it in a very real way in their lives. And having a topic like this that goes to the most intimate places of people's personal and religious lives and goes to some deep places of frustration and anger not be covered and addressed in an open way perpetuates a situation that I think long-term is unhealthy. So giving some more airing to a topic like this, I think, is very important. The other thing I'll add, and some of you were here in the spring when I tried to talk about some overarching themes about halakha, Jewish law more broadly, and what it means to actually find oneself within the discourse of halakha, to really become a student of rabbinic sources, be affected by them, find deeper meaning in them by studying them more deeply. In my experience, the topic of nida is a kind of unstated block for many people to sign on to the larger package of mitzvot and halacha. That is to say, they're able to connect with all kinds of other aspects of the Torah, mitzvot, etc., and then they will have this kind of blind spot on this topic that, for many people in my experience, eats away at their ability to take seriously the larger picture. And so to the extent that we can also put that out there and perhaps, I don't promise anything, but perhaps take some of that away such that we can more fully embrace the rabbinic discourse on what it means to live a holy life and understand ourselves within that conversation of Torah, that I think is another really important goal. Those are two of a number of things, but I'll start with this. Now, I want to issue a number of caveats, and then we're going to jump into the material. The first is captured by Chazal's pithy statement, Ein dorshin ba'arayot barabim. You don't have a lecture about sex in front of 80 people. Okay. But what that's capturing, right, what that is capturing is that there are topics that are private and sensitive in all kinds of ways that make the public analysis thereof complicated and potentially kind of trespassing in certain kind of ways of people's right to a certain degree of privacy, propriety in the public square, etc. So I want to say, by way of flagging that, to kind of lay a ground rule for myself and for all of us in this conversation, that I want this space very much to be a place where anger and frustration and honesty can very much come to the surface. That people can really, as we're encountering text, feel free to raise their hands to kind of contribute to the conversation in a way that is honest, and that if something is really difficult, and we'll get to some text tonight already that will be quite difficult, that this is a space where that can really be engaged head on. But that it also remains a space of reverence and privacy. And by reverence, I mean that when we talk about texts that make us upset or angry, that we try to find the language to talk about, this is how this text is making me feel. This is the way I feel very boxed into a corner by this text. This is the way I imagine this text causing pain, as opposed to language of, this text is horrible, stupid, offensive, etc. Not to deprive you of those feelings or to say they're illegitimate, but barabim, in this kind of space, I think will do better by tending towards the former than the latter. And as far as privacy, you should not assume about me or about anyone else, and I will not assume about anyone else, that a question or an issue that they bring to the table necessarily reflects something about their own personal biography. And people need to feel free to bring things up in this space that will not automatically be translated in the minds of everyone else in this room into a kind of voyeuristic window into what this person's private struggles are. And that's going to be a balance we'll just have to navigate over the next six sessions, but I want to put it out there front and center before we start. So that's one. A second caveat. I, for those of you who have noticed, am a man. And this is a topic that obviously has any number of problematic aspects to it to be discussed by a man. On the one hand, I want to also be forthright that part of my commitment to an egalitarian world of Torah is to resist the notion that because I'm a man, I cannot speak on this topic, and therefore I don't feel inhibited to take the Torah that I feel privileged to have learned on this topic and share it all with you. But I am fully aware that I cannot fully speak to this topic. There are other voices in this room that I hope will kind of supplement that and fill out that picture as we go along. I'll merely quote the Mishnah that reflects on another similar matter, oili im omar, oili im lo omar. There are perils to speaking and teaching, and there's perils to remaining silent. We're having this session, and we'll deal with the limitations as we go. Finally, I don't want to claim to be able to stand up here and kind of be able to account for everything in this topic, tie it all up in a bow. And I won't hold myself to the standard, and I hope you won't hold me to the standard of, unless I have explained to 100% satisfaction what X mitzvah or text is about, then I and we have failed in reaching some kind of rationale or motivation for why we should do something, why we maintain something, how it remains on the radar screen of halakha and mitzvot. That's a real question that everyone kind of has to deal with on some level, but I'm not going to hold myself to that standard for two reasons. One, the variety of human experience in response to all mitzvot, but in particular this one, makes it such that I am not sure there is a unitary answer to that question. I'm not sure that the question of what is the mitzvah, what are the regulations around nidah all about, which we'll begin to speak about presently, I'm not sure that does or should have a single answer that cuts across all of the human race, all of the Jewish people. And therefore, it may be misleading to go for one ta'am mitzvah, one reason that encapsulates it all. And the second thing, which is in some ways more important, is the reason behind any mitzvah, or the thrust, the sort of aim that is put out there in the world by a given mitzvah, what it's trying to achieve, looks drastically different depending on how that mitzvah is applied. Right? So a mitzvah might have a certain kind of valence if you determine that it applies even when the temple doesn't stand, as opposed to if you determine that it only applies when the temple is standing. Even if it's the same mitzvah in the same Torah, the application of that looks very different. Whether I take a mitzvah in the Torah that might be bounded to the land of Israel, right? The mitzvah of trumot and ma'asrot, let's say ma'aser ani, of giving of your tithes to the poor, right? If that's limited to the land of Israel, then that's no longer a mitzvah that is just about alleviating global poverty. Because it's been taken out of the application in question for Jews living everywhere else in the world. It's been limited to saying something else about what kind of society we're responsible for creating in Eretz Yisrael. To the extent I apply it more broadly, the meaning may look very different. So the only way we can really actually answer the question of what is a given mitzvah all about is to spend a lot of time looking at its application. So tonight, we are going to look at a number of what I've called here fundamentals, motivations, and critiques in an attempt to begin the topic by looking at some of the broad themes that inform it, I think, no matter how we tackle it. But we're going to spend the next five sessions looking at very specific blocks of halachic material in this topic and thinking about their application and their varieties of application. And in many ways, that will cause us to loop back constantly to tonight's opening presentation to think about, well, what of the paths that we considered are we now treading on? Where did we take a right turn, a left turn, and how might we go forward? Okay? So that's all by way of introduction. And with that, I want us to jump straight into the main psukim from the Torah. So you have a packet in front of you. It has 11 pages. And we have 80 minutes or whatever it is, okay? For those who haven't been to a series like this before, the format will be essentially interactive lecture. I'll be taking us through the various topics on this sheet with a basic outline of the material that I have in my head, but very much with the goal of stopping along the way and engaging both with the texts and the ideas that they raise. So if you look on pages 1 through 3, I've given you the core material in the Torah that lays out the normative basis for dealing with the topic of nida, dealing with the topic of menstruation and its penumbras and the various responses to it. Okay? And we have three basic blocks of text. What I want to do for the next 5 to 7 minutes is make sure we're clear on the data in those texts, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what that data might mean. Okay? So first of all, Vayikra Tet Vav, which is the first block on 1, and it's in English on page 2, leading into page 3, Vayikra 15, essentially has a chiastic structure. I modeled it, put it out here on the board, A, B, C, D, C, B, A. Okay? In the two A's, and I've laid out the paragraph so you can see that easily, though I didn't put A, B, C, D, C, B, A, which would have been useful. We have essentially the following structure. We have an introductory statement, Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe le'mor, tell Bnei Israel, and we have a concluding statement, which talks about keeping Bnei Israel away from Tum'ah, keeping the children of Israel away from Tum'ah, a term we will leave untranslated, and it's clear from the end, as it'll be clear from the middle, this entire chapter is dealing with how would you describe, for those of you who have seen this chapter before, what's the topic of this chapter? What kind of tum'ah? What's Vayikra 15 about? Bodily fluids, fluxes, discharges, all those great words and euphemisms people come up with, right? But we are dealing here with some kind of bodily fluxes that, and bodily itself being a euphemism, right? We're not talking about nosebleeds and colds, right? We're talking about discharges from the genitalia, from the sexual parts of the body, okay? And this is then laid out in, again, as I said, in a chiastic flow. We start first with the abnormal male discharge, what's known as the zav. We then continue with the normal male discharge, a seminal emission, what is known in rabbinic literature as Baal Keri. We then continue in D with sexual intercourse between man and woman. And then we go, quite predictably, to normal female discharge, nida in rabbinic literature and in other parts of the Torah as well, though the initial term there is confusing because it says v'isha ki tihya zava, and then abnormal female. Termed in rabbinic literature, a zava. Okay? Normal female, nida, what we would refer to as menstruation, a regular menstrual cycle. Abnormal female, dealing with bleeding, literally as it says here, below et nidata, at the unexpected time, at a time when a woman would not normally be expecting to see menstrual blood. Okay? Now, there's also a parallel, not just in the descriptions here, but in the actual treatment of the law, right? B and B both feature a requirement to wait 7 days for the body to reset. And if you look inside, as I'm talking this about this on the outside, you'll see, right? Safarlo, safrala, counting 7 days in order for the body to reset. And then at the end, what must the person do? Okay, so go to the mikvah. It says it in the case of the zav. It doesn't say it in the case of the zava. We'll come back to that in another session. So, but there is some kind of, for sure, for the zav and plausibly for the zava, a purification ritual. Good. And there's actually another key piece that they have to do. They have to bring a sacrifice. They have to bring a korban, okay, which is the sure sign that something pathological has gone on, something unusual, right? Something out of the ordinary has gone on that requires some kind of sacrificial response. Noteworthy that in C, the normal male and female, there is no requirement of a sacrifice. A woman doesn't bring a sacrifice every time she menstruates. A man does not bring a sacrifice every time he has a seminal emission. Also, in these cases, there is no requirement of counting for the body to reset. There are just fixed periods of how long this state of tum'ah, impurity, uncleanness, you know all the translations of that, we'll come back to it. I'm going to generally leave it untranslated to maintain the ambiguity, not for the sake of apology, but to maintain the ambiguity, the Ba'al Keri remains tameh for 1 day, and the nida remains tume'ah for 7 days. And at the end of that time, they go back to being tahor, plausibly with immersion in the mikvah as undoing that, but without any need for expiation through some kind of sacrifice. Okay? The male is 1 day. Why is the woman 7 days? We'll talk about that in a minute. Obviously, generally, the menstrual cycle lasts more than 1 day. It, for many women, lasts closer to 7 days, for some much fewer than that. You could imagine, even without getting too complicated, that in looking for a kind of, if you will, magic or significant number, the number that would most hit being on the upper level of covering the menstrual cycle, once you've passed basically 1 and 3 as plausible candidates, would be 7. And that may be all there is to it, but we can talk about that more. Okay? But that's the key structure of what goes on here. This chapter does not at all discuss the question of sex with a menstruant, with a zava, in any way that is explicitly prohibitive. All it addresses is the notion that if a man sleeps with a woman who is in nida, then he becomes tamei for 7 days, as she is tamei for 7 days. It is presented as a consequence. Now, whether this chapter assumes a prohibition is something that scholars argue over. In fact, Jacob Milgram, between volume 1 and volume 2 of his commentary on Leviticus, reversed himself. Suffice it to say, without getting into the question of whether you would deduce a prohibition from Vayikra Tetvav on its own, it does not speak that language. It speaks the language of consequence. Okay, I'll just tell this great story that we just heard yesterday from Rabbi Michael Rosenberg, who, in order to kind of illustrate the difference between the language of consequence and the language of prohibition, talked about being a counselor on a summer trip, and he was like the bus counselor. And in order to clean up the kids' filthy mouths, shall we say, they decreed that every time a kid used a curse word, they would have to put 25 cents into a pushcart at the front of the bus. And one of the kids came up 5 minutes later with a $10 bill and said, "This should cover me through the weekend." Okay, now what did he pick up on? He picked up on the fact that they didn't say it's forbidden to curse. Now obviously they thought it was a bad thing to curse, but they had talked the language of consequence. And there are clearly things that trigger tum'ah in this chapter that are not assumed to be forbidden, like intercourse between a man and a woman, which renders both of them tmeim. They have some kind of consequence that they have to go through some sort of purification rite, but we would never dream of saying, yeah, Leviticus 15 thinks that it's forbidden to have sex. So that's left undiscussed as to whether there's actually some kind of prohibition of having sex during menstruation in chapter 15. All right? Now, moving on, don't worry, we'll get more interactive once we're through this piece. Vayikra Yudchet, which is on the bottom of 1 and in the middle of 3. Here we get our first clear statement in the Torah of a prohibition. Be'el isha benidat tumata lo tikrav legalot ervata. Now, I want to just note this point here. We'll have occasion to return to it. What that phrase means. Benidat tumata, right? What does the word nida mean? Anyone want to take a crack at what nida means? What does that word mean? Aside from meaning menstruate, but meaning what is the word? What is the root? What is it about? Yeah?
From dava.
From dava. Aha. Uh-huh. So one possibility is that the nun is some kind of extra thing at the beginning, and it means dava, and dava means?
It is a negative connotation of sickness.
Some kind of illness, weakness, etc. Okay, so that's one possibility. Yeah?
Nadad.
Nadad, in the sense of?
Wandering.
Wandering, and what would that mean? How would that apply here? Okay, a possibility, but we're not quite sure how we connect. Yeah? Nidui, all right. And that would imply someone being cast out in some way, right? All right, if you look at Jacob Milgram on this, he'll say nida. He thinks the most plausible root is casting out. He posits, I'm not actually really sure, to be honest, where he gets this from, but he posits originally, it is referring literally to the blood being cast out of the woman's body. And later gets borrowed to be a term that goes more in the direction of nidui, a kind of social casting out that reflects the pushing away of the menstruous woman from the workings of society. All right, we'll come back to that. Whatever the original root is, I mean, you can go with Milgram or not on this. In the context of Yud Chet, it seems to be something along the lines of being cast out. Some have suggested that nadad and wandering may mean that, meaning pushed from one place to another. In which case, the simplest reading of this verse, which is how, for instance, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch explains it in his commentary on the Torah, do not be intimate with a woman who has been cast out on account of her impurity. Okay? And meaning, what was that? What would that most directly mean? That Vayikra Yudchet, chapter 18, is in fact implicitly hyperlinked back to chapter 15. Which is to say, chapter 15 tells you all the ways, and you can look at the regulations there, the ways in which a woman in a state of nida affects different objects that she touches, can communicate tum'ah, just like the zav can, right? That's talked about as well. The Zav and the Zava and the Nida and the Baal Keri, they have this capacity to affect the things that they touch. They are, as we know from the larger context of all those chapters in Vayikra, one of the areas that is off limits to them is anything that we would call Kodesh, Sancta of any sort. And this would then essentially be saying, when this woman is in a state of Tum'ah, in the sense of being removed from Sancta, you are not permitted to have sexual relations, right? That is to say, it's not a text that reads completely devoid of Vayikra Tedvav, right? Just to lay out like the radical possibility that reading opens up, okay, if you were only dealing with this phrase, one could conclude from that reading, for instance, oh, there's only a prohibition on having sex with someone who's menstruating when that menstruation has consequences of tumah. In a world in which there are no consequences for that, the woman is not cast out on account of her tumah. Right? That's not where we're going to end up in this story because of Vayikra Kaf that we're going to see in a minute. But I want you to understand the intimate linkage between Vayikra Yudchet and Vayikra Tetvav. One is essentially built on the other. One lays out a regime of tum'ah for all these different kinds of people, and the other chapter uses that regime of tum'ah to add a law that says, and by the way, there's also a sexual prohibition here. That which Vayikra Tetvav did not engage, because it only spoke the language of consequence, Vayikra Yudchet does engage and say, this is actually forbidden. Okay? That's the difference between Yudchet and Tetvav. But I also highlighted for you here in the Hebrew all the ways in which the word tameh appears over and over and over again in chapter 18 to show you the ways in which that language framework of tum'ah is very much informing what is going on in Yudchet. Okay? Now, last verse, and then we'll take kind of a round of comments before we go on to the next piece. Vayikra Kaf is a whole other matter. Vayikra 20, on the top of 2 and on the bottom of 3, is actually a pericope, there's a fancy Bible word, that stands on its own, that has nothing to do with tumah at all. The word tumah barely appears in that chapter. It appears in sort of figurative ways, but not in any way remotely resembling how it appears in 15 and 18. And what does it say here? Here the language, the framework is one of kiddusha, holiness, sanctity, not of tumah. And here we get a simple verse. V'ish asher yishkav et isha dava v'gila et ervata et mekora he'era v'hi gilta et mekor damea. Here we get a couple of important details. One, the woman here is not described as a nida or a zava, though Charlie's suggesting maybe those two are not so different, nida and dava. But here the language is one of a woman who is weak, who is ill, and if a man sleeps with her, he has somehow revealed, uncovered her source, and the source here is clear, the source of blood. And interestingly enough, then a reciprocal statement. And she, too, has inappropriately revealed her source of blood. And therefore, v'nichritu shneihem. Both of them have done something wrong. And here we get the ominous and scary penalty of karet, the notion of being somehow cut off. How you explain what that is about is a huge debate, right? In even rabbinic sources themselves. I often, when I'm trying to explain karet to my kids, kind of almost explain it descriptively. There's a sense in which v'nichrita nefesh ahi me'ameha, like when you tell it in the context of chametz, it's like someone who eats chametz on Pesach has, they took themselves out. Like they're completely out of the whole story we're trying to create here. Someone who doesn't offer the korban Pesach and doesn't bring it, they get karet, they're out. Someone who doesn't circumcise their son, they're out. They're writing themselves out of the basic narrative we've constructed of who we are. With the arayot, too, the forbidden sexual relationships, there seems to be something that's hanging over this entire section that's essentially saying, we're constructing our entire society around certain kinship structures, taboos, certain understandings of who is intimate with whom and not. If you cross those lines, you're kind of out of the whole picture that we're creating here. Okay? We'll have to do some work to understand, well, what does that mean here? Right? Why? How is this cutting someone out of that larger story? But we're adding here the penalty of karet, but I also want you to know this has nothing to do with tumah whatsoever. And to sharpen that for a minute, if I gave you this verse, it is not at all clear that you would come up with a 7-day prohibition. Based on this verse alone, you would likely conclude, oh, when a woman is bleeding, it's forbidden to have sex. End of story. If that lasts 3 days, it's 3 days. If it's 5 days, it's 5 days. It has nothing to do with there being some penumbra of tum'ah that we construct about that. Which, by the way, I just learned yesterday, is in fact the Muslim approach to the ban on sex during menstruation. It's not a 7-day period. It's while the woman is menstruating, it's forbidden. Okay? So you should have a sense now, I hope, and this is where I kind of pause and take questions and comments at this point, of three very different passages. Vayikra Tetvav, which talks the language of consequence and is a very is overall a very egalitarian passage and structure, right? I'm not claiming it's an exactly same regime for men and women, but it is a whole chapter that is set up assuming that both men and women have normal and abnormal flows, and they get different responses, okay? And I'll point out to you, this will be sort of an important point later, that in a world in which all of this is operative, it is not at all clear that women are tmeot that much more than men are tmeim. Right? What may be true is that women are tmeot for longer blocks of concentrated time, but a man with a seminal emission that can happen at any point, right, that may affect his status with much more kind of punctuated frequency than the woman is necessarily affected between normal periods. We'll get also to the developments in medicine and health and all of that that have made menstruation much more common today than it probably ever was in the ancient world. But the point is, that's one picture, and it talks the language of consequence. There is then Vayikra Yudchet, which uses that language of consequence to actually build up a prohibition. And then Vayikra Kaf, which stands on its own as basically a response to blood, and that is emphasized as being kind of incumbent equally on the man and the woman. Okay, ad kan with the data. What I want to now open up is, first of all, any points that people feel like they want to clarify or they need to make sure you've tread over well enough before we go into all sorts of other details. And also to begin to elicit from you, what do you make of this data? What does this data seem to produce in terms of the question if I were to ask you, what is this about? Yeah. I'm sorry, Jacob Milgram, we don't have it on the shelf. Jacob Milgram, Zichrono Livracha, passed away this past year, was, I would say, the foremost scholar on Leviticus of our time, is the author of the Anchor Bible Commentary on Leviticus. It doesn't mean that he's, everyone universally agrees with everything he said, but has done really the most kind of comprehensive thinking about the book of Vayikra, and so you'll hear me talking about him frequently. But you can find it, like, on Amazon and other places. Great scholar and actually, like, a fairly readable work of scholarship. Yeah?
What time period is the even?
The even, yeah. Let's assume, to keep our purposes simple here, we're talking about sunset. Maybe we're talking about nightfall. But we're talking, it's in normal English, which is not public domain online, we would call it the evening. Okay. Hopefully that clarifies. Yeah?
Just want to make sure you repeat the question.
Yes, repeating the question. What is even? It is evening. Yes. Okay, but we'll make sure we repeat all the questions. Yes?
Why not treat them separately, especially the first two? I mean, why read chapter 18 as building on the language of consequence and not read it as whatever you do with it?
Because I would want to know why it says, why not read 15 and 18 separately? Why not read 18 as its own thing? I would want to know why it uses the language of Tum'ah without ever telling me what that's about. If I assume it told me what that was about in 15, then the Pasuk makes perfect sense. Alternatively, if the Pasuk in Yud Chet had said, Ve'elisha bitum'at nidata lo tikrav, then I would be inclined to say, oh, tum'ah there means in the horrible state of nidata, being a menstruant. But when it's read as benidat tum'ata, and tum'ah is the thing that is causing some kind of nida, and the nida there cannot mean menstruation because of its smichut form, right? I mean, it can't mean in the menstruation of her impurity. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense, right? So that's what inclines me and Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and Baruch Schwartz and other scholars, etc., to read it that way, because it seems to be linking us back to that earlier piece. While Kaf clearly has nothing to do with that, right? And just maybe to retread that again, even if I said, Vayikra Yudchet, in a world in which we don't observe Tuma and Tara, disappears, I'm not saying that's so simple to say, but even if we said that, you still have to deal with Vayikra Kaf. That's not going to address what the 20th chapter is getting at. Yeah?
In looking at Vayikra Kaf, could you maybe venture to explain what the underlying value, or like why, like where this is coming from? Tuma, I understand, or like I'm kind of make a case for like why you have the things from that, but why with, how does it affect Kedusha? Like, can you make a case for that a little bit?
Great. So that's what we're going to turn to now. I invite you to chime in if you have an initial thought on this, but I want to crowdsource here a little about ideas of what do we think this is about? Meaning, look at this data, and I don't expect you to have it totally synthesized in your head, but what would you say? Someone asks you, the anthropologist from Mars comes down and says, I see, Ma avodah zot lachem. What is this about? Yeah.
I'm wondering if it's relevant to the conversation to think about how often a woman actually menstruates in her lifetime in a biblical period. If women were married at the age of 10 or 11, immediately began to procreate or nursing for long periods of time, and died in childbirth,
I think it's very relevant. That's the kind of question, though, that I would say. I think this is an important distinction. It's the kind of question that is highly, highly relevant for application, figuring out how might this then apply differently, or how might we react to it differently in a world in which that's not the case anymore. But I'm not sure it exempts us from saying, still really then the core question of, fine, make it infrequent, so what's it about, right? Even in the world in which it's infrequent, what's it about, okay? So what's it about? What do you have to say? What's it about? And you can say things, here's what I think it's about, and I think it's terrible if that's what it's about. But what do you think it's about? Yeah, Alan. Okay. I'm going to just... We don't have... Do we have, like, a eraser for this? So I can put some things up.
While you're getting it, I will martyr my hand to the blue ink. Okay, go ahead. Yes, so amazement with sexuality and reproduction, is that what you said? Say it out. Yeah.
I think there was this sense of awesomeness that, like, from our own bodies and these emissions that we don't really understand, it's somehow related.
All right, and how would this explain it? Why is there something icky about that? There's something scary about it, meaning?
Yeah, I think there's something scary. I mean, I guess bodily emissions on the most basic levels they're not valuable, or not something you want to keep, and they're something that seem dirty.
Okay.
And I think they're trying to figure out how that's related to holiness and the whole structure within that.
All right. So actually, that's sort of another angle that you raised there at the end. I understand you're merging them, but we could also disentangle them, which is some kind of notion of, disgust, or you even use the language of dirty, right? The notion of something that is, it's a substance I'm kind of revolted by, or I have some kind of negative reaction to, even as that might also create some wonder. All right, we'll take a few, we'll go around. Nigel, F, and we'll go around the room. Yeah.
I thought your comment earlier on about saying this isn't about bodily discharge because it's not about mucus and it's not about saliva and it's not about other things is, I just think, very, very interesting. I think that the category of discharges that are being talked about here are all fundamentally to do with life and the possibility of life and, as it were, the loss of the possibility of life. And I think, although that phraseology isn't used, I think it's at least reasonable to presume there's some connection there.
Okay. Great. Yes. F, and then...
I'll sort of use the same computer. I feel a little uncomfortable out of place saying this, speaking as a man, but the Tanakh definitely seems to have an obsession at certain points with dam, with blood. As a matter of fact, I think chapter right before Leviticus 18, Leviticus 17, it was all about blood. And I've heard actually Christian missionaries quote that as a proof text for why blood was so important to Jesus. But also in Deuteronomy, there seems to be, in several cases in the Bible, this idea that blood is very important, blood represents life, and therefore there may be some connection between being a nida and tuma and the fact that blood being involved somewhere, somehow, how I'm not going to speculate except to say that it may be connected somehow.
Okay. Oh, well.
Just summarize the points for the viewers.
And by the way, welcome to the viewers at home. The points that have been raised so far, that some of the key themes informing this discourse may be reacting to sexuality and procreation, having issues of disgust, dirt, response to things that seem like they are offensive or repulsive, life or loss thereof, and discharges that are specifically related to that may be key, and blood in particular as a response to life and death. Now, I hope as you're hearing these comments, you're starting to both build them up and poke holes in them from all the aspects, right? Because this is great for explaining Nida and Zava. It's terrible for explaining Zav and Baal Keri, which have nothing to do with blood, right? This is great for giving sort of a broader theory of what all these fluids and discharges have in common. It doesn't necessarily get to why is the term nida and the image of the tum'ah of the menstruant used to great prophetic effect in a way that the zav is never really used similarly. I shouldn't say that the zav is used when you want to curse someone out. You say he should be a zav and his entire family should be zavim for the rest of their lives. Right, that's what David says to Yoav, and it happens in other places of Tanakh. So I don't know, maybe I have to revisit that. But fine, you get my point. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like there's a sense of mysteriousness and unknown, and kind of like the less we know about it, the more we fear. So there's longer waiting for the abnormal fluids, and the sense of the Gilad, Ermatat, and the Korad, or something like mysterious that we shouldn't be revealing.
Okay, there's something terrifying about certain things, or at least, right, and this is where we can start also to get to gaps, right? And one of the gaps we might imagine feeling is maybe it's less mysterious to us. Maybe we actually know a lot more. Maybe it's much more predictable to us. Maybe, actually, it's so not mysterious because I know it's going to come exactly when I get to, pill number X, right, in the series, right? Like, it may put it in a totally different lens. But nonetheless, we could sort of imagine that as an issue. Great. Okay, we're going to take these four and then cut it. Yes, please.
In Vayikra 20, you jump from verse 18 to 26, and in between there's the oft-cited, don't do these things because that's what the people did before you, who I'm, and I'll throw you out like I'm throwing them out if you do them. And maybe that can even carry over to the earlier articulations also.
Great, but let me just push you a little further. What was so terrible about this thing, right? Meaning the people there also planted crops, but we don't think that's horrible because we don't find anything horrible with planting crops. So I agree with you that it totally seems linked to that. It seems like that may be another practice that was tolerated there, but why is the Torah revolted by it? By sex during menstruation, right? Meaning why is that go on the list of things, don't do that thing that they did?
Yeah, I mean, it's included with this list of close kinship.
Right. Great. Okay. Good. Yeah, please.
I think it's very cool that you mentioned the intention of life and loss of life. I think this beginning of the Zrida, after the woman gives birth, for the first 7 days, she's considered that Yiga and Dava, but then when she thinks afterward, it depends on whether it's a boy or a girl, it's actually in Tara. So the meaning of it, according to the Torah, is life.
Okay, so we see there's this other chapter, which, yes, I thought about putting in but decided not to at the beginning of chapter 12. That's the entirety of chapter 12, which deals with the woman who gives birth. And the language of kimei nidat dvotah titma is actually used there. There's also a link here. And that's obviously kind of a life-producing process, and yet there's this process of the body kind of almost going through a death that it has to heal from by shedding that life. So there's clearly some powerful nexus there. Yes, Tamar. But let's Tamar and then you.
it occurs to me that this seems to be in a lot of ways about control. That menstruating is something that now we actually have a fair amount of control over it, but it used to be something that you had no control over whatsoever. It happened when it was going to happen, nothing to really do about it. And the same has to do with sexual omission, but in the way that they're talking about it, that they were experiencing it as something out of control. And I think that the issue of exerting something that you don't have control over at base is kind of something that a lot of people want to do just to kind of make their life more orderly. And it seems like something that you would
Okay, so controlling the uncontrollable and that being specifically potentially attractive and important in the context of sex. Great. Yes. Okay, so this is actually a really tricky and important point. There's separation and difference, and that seems to suggest other people are not doing it. And if you read it in the context of those verses that I left out, that a lot of these prohibitions are about differentiating the Israelites entering the land from the indigenous people who are doing horrible things, you can easily come to a place of saying, oh, maybe this is actually just like a weird practice. Now, and I agree with you, in its application in many contexts today, one could get that impression. Now, quite frankly, as Rabbi Aviva is fond of reminding me, we have almost no data on this to actually really know. I mean, there have been some surveys, but the relative amount of data to actually know, even if we were to ask, like, what goes on in America? Like, how does your average couple deal with menstruation in the bedroom? I don't feel at all confident to say that we have kind of enough data to answer that question. What we can say is that, and we'll get back to this, that is largely banished from the public sphere as conversation, right? That's for sure, okay? And that may give a feeling of some kind of separation and difference. One of the things that is striking, though, which Milgram points out, is that basically every ancient Near Eastern society had a menstrual taboo and had restrictions on sex during that period. And therefore, what might be the difference might not be the creation of the category, but the dealing with the category, the way in which it's dealt with. Now, one of the things that Milgram also argues, where I think sometimes he goes a little bit overboard verging into apologetics, I'm not sure I go the whole distance, but the big picture is sort of a compelling thesis that he draws out in a number of places, is that a lot of Vayikra and its discussions of Tum'ah have to be understood against an ancient Near East backdrop of taking the demonic extremely seriously. Taking seriously the notion that there are forces that operate outside of God that wreak havoc in the world. And that actually what Vayikra does is takes all of those things and says, no, that's not a demon. That just renders you tameh. It's all under God's purview, and you just go through the purification ritual, and you're back even to the holiest space, right? That is to say, one of the mistakes we sometimes make when we look back, when we just drop Vayikra into our contemporary world, is as if Vayikra invents the category of menstruation being socially significant and there being sexual taboos about it. In fact, if you pay close attention to the Torah seems to flag this. Because even in the first description of a woman who is menstruating, and the response, it says, V'isha ki tihye zava, dam yihye zova bivsara, shivat yamim tihye v'nidata. She'll be in her state of being cast out for 7 days. But when did you even tell me that she had to be cast out or that she was a nida or anything of that sort? I would expect something like Shivat Yamim Tihyeh Bin Nidui or Bin Nida, not Bin Nidata, like in her, as if it's something she made up, right? It's like her state that she's in, yeah, for 7 days. If you actually read a lot of the psukim, what they actually seem to be is everyone knows that a menstruating woman is Bin Nida, as it were. What we're telling you is that lasts for 7 days. If you touch this, it matters. If you don't touch this, it doesn't matter. If you sit on this, it matters. If you don't do this, it doesn't matter. We're giving you the regulations around it, not inventing the category. Now, where that leaves us for then thinking about how that translates today, right? This is always a question. When you deal with biblical text to which you assign a vector, right? I remember one of my one of my wife's friends sort of describing. He was like, the basic idea of Judaism is when they were for child sacrifice, we were for animal sacrifice. Then when they got past child sacrifice and they were for animal sacrifice, we were against sacrifice. And this sort of progressive view of, right, I identify, and it's not, you know, it's not totally crazy, right? I identify kind of, I mean, the Rambam says as much in the Mor Nevuchim, right? Like, that the vector of a mitzvah is actually what's relevant. So taking that kind of, you know, more radical read of what's going on here, you might say, oh, they're taming the demonic. They're trying to get people to stop freaking out about this. If the world has caught up to taming the demonic, then I should go one step further and simply wipe the whole thing off the map, right? Now, that's one way of reading. Obviously, another way of reading is to say, well, wait a minute, it may be responding to a reality, but it may also still, particularly in Vayikra Kaf, be responding to some other things. All right, so I want to take us through some of those other things now. We've got about 35 minutes left, and we're going to get kind of just a cursory view. We're not going to read all these sources. As you know, from those who have studied with me, I like to give you stuff to take home and think about further. I have tried to lay out here, and some of it maps onto what you suggested here, at least 7 different categories of why. And I give you the 7 different categories, not because that's a magic number deliberately picked, but by way of trying to kind of emphasize what I hinted at to in the beginning, which is, I'm not sure this topic is most profitably analyzed by saying, this is the reason, as opposed to saying, this is a really ancient and really widespread practice. How might I understand what are all the inputs that have made it last so long? And which of those inputs still make sense, which make less sense, which would lead to this kind of application, and which would lead to that kind of application. And to try to take them all seriously before we take seriously the ways in which they might also grate up against some of what we assume to be true. So the first is, to put it out just directly, disgust, fear, and danger. The notion that, and now I'm narrowing my focus, right, from that chiastic chart, talking about menstruation and female uterine bleeding in general, okay? Disgust, fear, and danger. And here I've brought you a number of sources, right? Yechezkel. I mean, this is like one of the hardest psukim. Whenever we get to Parshat Para, it's like, I'm like, what do I do with the beginning of this Haftarah, which uses the model, the mashal, right, the parable of the nida as the way to talk about someone who is helplessly corrupt. You don't think that's what it means?
No, I think it's in daily talk. It's in weekly talk.
We're getting there. We're getting to that right there. But weekly tachanun is like, no. This is like, ketum atanida, haita darkam lefanai.
It bothers me then too. I'm just
okay, I got you. We're going to get to it, right? But the thing I want you to understand, that pasuk in Yechezkel is, that comparison only makes sense if you completely intuitively assume that the nida is something reviling. Otherwise, if you're like, you know, Rabbi Lamb, Hedge of Roses, like, you know, Rabbi Steinsaltz, like, this is all about just, like, getting into some deeper inner you, you're like, what do you mean they destroyed it like Tumat HaNida? That's like a beautiful, great thing, right? So it doesn't make any sense unless it's completely reviling in an intuitive, basic way. The Bavli and Psachim, despite the fact that the Talmud Bavli, as we'll have occasion to see, does a lot of stuff to actually minimize a lot of the Tum'ah overlays onto Nida. I shouldn't say overlay, some of the core, right? It tries to actually push them aside. There's still some deep cultural material that assumes certain things about Nidot and about menstruating women. Talmud Bavli 111a, a menstruating woman is between two men. She'll kill one of them if it's the beginning of her period, and she'll cause them to fight if it's at the other end. Right? Now, what is that? That's a fear of something. There's a power. You might even say that's the demonic. In the next one, it's sort of actually unbelievable. A snake is threatening to bite a woman. How does she scare it off? She throws some of her hair and nails, which has its own, you know, sort of liminal status, and just says, I'm menstruating. It doesn't even have to be true. And the snake will so freak out, say, I don't want to be anywhere near that, right? Well, what does that reflect? That's a projection of, this is something everyone knows you stay away from. Okay? What Ashira already quoted in Tachanun, in Seder of Amram Gaon. Okay? We're here in the 9th century in Babylonia, and it's still in you know, your standard, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, an orthodox siddur, a traditional siddur, whatever it is, the text of Tachanun, as not recently edited, okay, let's put it that way, says, v'shiktsunu kitumat anida. How do you describe the way the goyim have treated the Jews? Like we, basically, right, treat menstruates. I mean, that's what that line says, okay? For those of you who are seeing it for the first time, I now know you've never made it to the end of Tachanun. Okay? Yeah, like, I don't say that line, okay? But it's there. All right, Moreh Nevuchim. I think the Rambam here is very important. For all the things, people try to say, oh, I don't know, who knows what this is about, right? Rambam doesn't give you a reason for what it's about. Why? Because he says, it's totally obvious what it's about. It's as obvious as why you can't sleep with your neighbor's wife. Which is basically saying, everyone knows that this is something repulsive. Of course, you stay away from it. The Sefer Achinuch, similar language. Okay? Now, I want to just, before leaving that topic, kind of complicate it for you for 1 minute. Yeah, fine.
I'm curious if it's possible to read Tumat Hanida as something else, as talking about the power that comes along with being a Nida. That it's not saying like we treat the Nida, it's like we treat the Tumat Hanida, and you see that word throughout all of them. And maybe it's that they defiled it by their women that they're doing the lady for me with as the tuma as a menstruating woman. And maybe the reason we passed her away is because she has so much power, and that same power was used for destruction. Maybe it's just...
It's definitely possible, and I don't want to take away from anyone the possibility for that to work if it works, right? What I would say to maybe give voice to those who would say it doesn't work for them is, I don't know, then I would think like once I would see something of like v'shiktsunu ketumat met. Which, when you're talking about the actual kind of halachic arch categories of tum'ah, rests above nida. Right? That is to say, if all I'm talking about of the power, it's the corpse defilement is the real defilement that I would use as the ultimate example. The problem is corpse defilement, I think, why it's not as compelling a metaphor in these texts, doesn't have the same socially instinctive revulsion, and therefore it doesn't command the same response. But maybe not, right? Okay? I just want to complicate that piece before leaving it, okay? Because that's a piece that's sort of the easiest to say, wow, I really don't feel that way, okay? But what if people do feel that way, even if you don't like it? I want to just flag that for us as something to not take totally lightly, particularly in the context of sex. What if your partner is completely reviled by something that you think they shouldn't be reviled by, but they are? Is it an obvious option? It might be, but is it an obvious option that completely ignoring that and blowing past it is a successful strategy for dealing with that disgust? I don't know. And I think I want to just put in your heads the possibility that that's not so simple. And that's what this last text from Bavli Shabbat deals with. It's this fascinating case where it says, Rav says, anything that the Chachamim don't allow you to wear out into public on Shabbat, because they don't really consider it to be clothing. It's like something, you're basically carrying something by putting it on your body and thereby violating the core concern of not taking things from a private space to a public space on Shabbat. Except, meaning if you can't wear it into the public space, you can't wear it into the chatzer. You can't wear it into the courtyard. Even though the courtyard is not that big a deal, it's only rabbinically forbidden to bring things from your house into the courtyard. Nonetheless, you can't do it. Except hairnets and wigs. Women can wear hairnets and wigs. Why? Ula says, so that kedei shelo titgane al ba'ala, that she not become unattractive to her husband. Now again, we can deconstruct all the local data. What does that mean? Et cetera, et cetera. It's actually an interesting reversal, right? It's like the man will be sort of be turned off by the fact that the woman has been sort of unmodestly, inappropriately dressed in public in some way, that he won't be able to somehow appreciate her less clothed, intimate space with him. We could figure out exactly what's going on there. But I bring you this text, and then you see it's extended into the context of Nida to see a conversation, admittedly by men. Okay? Admittedly by men, but nonetheless, men are one half of these relationships, right? Dealing with certain fundamental facts and reactions and trying to figure out how to respond to them. And so I just want to say that putting disgust kind of on the table as one reaction doesn't necessarily wipe off the map a conversation of how to deal with that unless it really doesn't exist anymore. And if you really live in a reality where actually, no, there's no reaction, and that were the only thing behind nida, then you would basically find some way to say it doesn't apply anymore. But I think we just have to be careful about sometimes assuming people have actually gotten over things that they might not be completely past. Yeah, Ben.
That's kind of like a total out of job revision, though, because when people that are somewhere out of the car, sometimes, like, for example, if you haven't eaten cheeseburgers your whole life, then you eat a cheeseburger, you might think it's disgusting, just because that's been such a taboo for you. So to say that for a community that's Shomer Halakha, that is disgusting, well, of course it's disgusting, because there's a huge biblical taboo against it.
Yeah,
you know,
so...
like it's societally constructed, so...
Good. So, first of all, yes, and that is true, and that would mean that one would expect that potentially after breaking through that taboo sufficiently, it might actually change attitudes in that regard. But I would also say to you, in agreement to your point, but also to push back on it, the relevant data here might be the general culture's response as well. I would not say the general American male culture's response to menstruation is completely neutral. That might be a terrible thing. I'm not here to kind of defend and reify that, but I also don't think that kind of denying that, and again, if we're to go back to vectors and kind of dealing with if Vayikra is in some ways taming something that's out there, right? Even with that reading, if there's something still out there, you might have to figure out some way that you tame them, right? That doesn't then produce, like, every seif in the Shulchan Aruch, and that's not my point in the lecture tonight. The point here is to just lay that out there as an issue. Okay? One other comment on this. Yes, Rachel.
So we started out with four categories, right? What happened to the other three?
Great. So we're going to come back in a deeper way to what happened to the other three in terms of the Tum'ah dropping out. Let me try to just shift your question to we can ask more directly. Why is there no ban on a woman sleeping with a man in a certain kind of state? Okay? That, I think, is actually for this local question of the ban on sexual encounter. Why is there no reverse case? So, you know, there's a couple possibilities, right? One is, look, the seminal emission is obviously out. You can't forbid a woman from sleeping with a man who has a seminal emission, right? That's not possible, okay? So that category is basically gone. You can say they're both Tmeim, which Vayikra Tedvav does, and then we have to ask why is that Tum'ah regime not in place?
Yes, but there's a distinction between seminal emissions during sex and seminal emissions after sex. If we're talking about loss of life, not a good thing.
So yeah, but that wouldn't necessarily generate a taboo. We're asking, why isn't there a taboo in the Torah? Well, what would that look like, though?
Like, if a guy has a wet dream and it's embarrassing or something.
You're saying then she can't sleep with him for a day after?
Yeah, why not? I mean,
uh-huh. Okay, I don't have an answer for that. That's a good point. I don't have an answer for that. The closest I can grope for one right now is that it might be that Vayikra Tetvav is not in any way thinking about the difference between intentional and inadvertent, and therefore does not have access to the notion that those two would be different. But of course, that you can just beg the question, why doesn't it have access to that? Right? I mean, it is clear that intention does not play some role there in both directions, right? It's not like the man is like, well, I didn't know she was menstruating, so I'm not tamei. No, like, he is also in that case. So I have to think about that more, but that's one thing I would say. Then there's the question of whether the zav in the state of his ziva is actually capable of having intercourse, right? It's possible that he is not. To the extent that he is, right, then I don't know. Right? And that's where, this is where I'm going to have recourse to, I'm not claiming to sort of tie this all up in a bow in that way, and that's another good question to kind of push forward. What I will say is there are some other reasons that we might imagine why it would not be symmetrical. All right, that's what I want you to see now, another example. Another possibility for what is going on here is the notion of bodily vulnerability. This is a flat out, let's just flag it right now, it's a total paternalistic explanation. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have some validity to it. Yechezkel actually refers to sleeping with a nidah with the verb used for rape. He says, Tmeata nidah inu vach. And the Radak picks up on this in his commentary, and he says, why does it use the word inui? Why does it say inu, the word inui? Because im yivalua benidata, yesh la inui. That basically, and again, I'm interested for the kind of final application of this, but I'm not as interested for the theorizing of what's going on here as to how true this is for how many people. But the positing here is that it will be painful and a kind of a form of rape for a man to sleep with a menstruating woman. Now, just to play that out, why that's not necessarily a completely insane thing to say, one, you have to remember a society and a framework in which it is assumed that in general, men basically have sexual rights over their partners, and therefore, by default, they are entitled to sex essentially whenever they want it. The Torah does not give any sense that the woman has some kind of prerogative right to refuse sex as a general matter. Okay? One can imagine within a framework where there is an assumption that some of the discourse around nidah, particularly where the nidah is referred to at times as a dava, as a weak woman, as someone who is vulnerable, that part of it might be a concern that the man not have sex at that time. Right? If you think about nidah in this sense, in the larger context of Vayikra Yudchet and basically all the familial relations, there is a coherent way of reading that chapter that it's essentially saying, we don't want the pater familias, who is at the head of the clan and living with all these different women who are his relatives to one degree or another in his larger, you know, courtyard complex, to be able to be totally sexually dominant with all of these women. And that's why he can't sleep with his sister and his mother-in-law, etc., etc., etc. And among those in the list is another person he could take advantage of. That's the Radak's reading. Okay? And I want to throw it out to you just as another thing that may be informing some of the discourse, and to which point of view would say to me, fine, but then the woman should have the right to waive it if she doesn't care. There's always that's never a great claim, because for a regime like this to be successful, you need a certain kind of democracy before the law so that no husband can ever pressure his wife into waiving her rights. Okay? Again, I don't know how much I think that comprehensively explains. I don't think it'd be taken off the table. Listen.
I'm just really confused, because a man can have sex with a virgin, even though he's been experienced.
Correct. That's what I thought when I read the Radak too. Right. So here's the best answer I can give for you on that, when I thought on that, is you can't never have men have sex with virgins. That is not a solution that the society can deal with. Okay? And therefore, that has to be absorbed. That just somehow has to be dealt with. But here, there's no need whatsoever for the functioning society to have to allow sex with a menstruator. That's the best answer I can give. And yeah, it causes pain. Some things cause pain that are necessary for society to function. But if you don't have to, yeah, Josh.
Might there be some sort of experience of violence? Because I'm thinking about the image of blood and the source of blood and piercing that source. You know, it's a violent image. And similarly, so is the one about having sex with a virgin, right? With the bleeding, it seems like you're hurting somebody. Even if theoretically there's not technically pain, it's a violent act. It's similar to, I don't know, you're not allowed to eat raw meat. But it also, it's like you're an animal.
Okay, the presence of blood and what that evokes and why one would be horrified by it, for sure, it may play a role in this, and I think it also potentially plays a role in another category that we'll see that Milgram plays out. So for sure. Yeah, good that you raised that. Yeah, one more on this segment. Yeah.
All of these notions of violence and sex or prohibitions on having sex with certain people, equating it to rape in the Yehezekiel 22:10.
Mm-hmm.
Toward a prerogative of creating equality in the spiritually. So by separating out these specific times, the time when it is permitted, they're more aligned and they can have a more equal, sexual relationship.
And how do we guarantee the man's presence in that? He doesn't need to be guaranteed, or you see that somehow being protected also?
Well, I think in just the same way that that there are prohibitions against having sex while one of the partners is in a different altered state, such as being drunk or angry, that's the way you guarantee that.
All right, so certainly where that's a great example of sort of application, right? The more we would see in later poskim that the ban on having sex during menstruation would be embedded within a whole larger framework of not doing things in a certain state, the more that would be sort of a compelling explanation of at least what the mitzvah had come to mean. Whether it meant that in Vayikra, maybe we'd be less certain, and that's why with all of these things, right, what I want to sort of less to say, this is it, this is what Vayikra is about, and more poles of influence that then we might expect us to go in different directions, right? The next one is a great example. C, Philo of Alexandria, talks about, I won't read it inside, just talks about the notion that what's the problem with menstruation? Menstruation is the time when the female body is sending the quintessential signal that conception is not possible right now. All right, now what if it's in a later day, etc. But you get the basic idea, which is that obviously the shedding of the uterine lining is the marker of the previous cycle of possibility has ended, okay? And they knew this, right? How do you know from the Torah that they knew this, that menstruation has to do with the ability to give birth? Sarah, chadaliyot v'sarah orach kanashim, right? And that was the weird thing. She gave birth even though she wasn't menstruating. That's not supposed to happen, right? So the notion that Philo plays out is essentially he sees this as just one element in not wanting sex to be completely detached from procreation. Now, Philo takes that further, and he basically thinks it's just as bad to be married to someone who is barren as it is to have sex with a menstruating woman, right? Inconsistency, he sort of plays that out. I would suggest to you, even someone who doesn't go that far might still say that there's a difference between a sexual act where the way the picture looks, even with birth control, that the way the picture looked is like a picture where the body might be receptive to conception at this point, as opposed to one where the body is actively sending a symbol to you that that is impossible. And you know it from your experience of what the body is doing, it is impossible. And that has actually taken the decoupling of sex from procreation too far. That's how sort of the idea being laid out in Philo would play out. Yes, you had a question.
There's a woman who asked a question with the comment in it about not being able to have sex when you're angry or drunk. And, I'm just wondering, is that actually halachic? I've never heard that before.
That shows up in sources that talk about things that, they'll often be framed as a man before he makes advances on his wife should not do so if she is in some kind of altered state of mind, et cetera, et cetera. Now, will those sources ever reach the same fever pitch of karet, spiritual excision, around that kind of situation as they will around menstruation? No. But as a sort of larger framework of being concerned about when sex is or is not appropriate, it definitely are a whole host of, codes and authorities that indeed maintain that as something that's very important. It's definitely said about the female partner. I think it's said about him too, but I'm not holding. The Rambam talks about this. It comes up in the Shulchan Aruch. I have to check it for you. Yeah, it's worth checking. Yes, please, take these two comments and then.
I'm not aware of any prohibitions that you can't make love with your wife or partner when they're pregnant.
Correct.
And it's quite obvious even back then that you would not be able to conceive when you're pregnant.
Yes. Now, whether Philo thought this or not, we know that Chazal, rabbinic sources, thought that sex during pregnancy helped the pregnancy. So they actually put it under the rubric of procreation in the sense that it actually both helping the woman, helping the fetus, etc., and therefore it sort of gets domesticated under that. But again, it's not a perfect picture, but I also think it's not crazy either, right, to say that actually isn't my body, this person's body, telling me something? And maybe there's some kind of response to that fact. But yeah, that's sort of the edges of that piece. Yes, please.
I just want to clarify, by barren, does he mean menopausal?
No, he means unable to conceive.
So what about a menopausal partner?
Yeah, he frowns on that too. Yeah. I mean, Philo goes the whole distance with this. I'm suggesting to you, I think there's something in that idea that lives on without having to go the whole distance. Okay? All right, a couple of things here. D is just a fascinating text. I mean, I actually think it has nothing to do with what's going on, but it's sort of unbelievable that something in 12th century France, when talking about male circumcision, Rav Yosef Bechorshor, exegete on the Torah, feels that something is missing for women. He's basically asking, you know, Shaya Cohen, the scholar, wrote this book, why aren't Jewish women circumcised? So Rav Yosef Bechorshor's answer was because they menstruate. It's actually an unbelievable formulation. The woman's kind of regulation of her sexual relationship with her husband through menstruation, hu lahem dam brit. That is their covenantal blood. Men have their experience of covenantal blood a day eight in the sexual organ. Women have their experience of covenantal blood in the sexual organ by regulating their sexual interactions with their partners. Again, do I think that's Pshat of Vayikrach Yud Cheder Kav? No, but it's a pretty unbelievable text. Okay? Yeah.
So it's the regulation of that menstruation that's the covenant? Because
that's how he formulates
it. Menstruate too.
What's that?
Non-Jewish women menstruate
too. Yeah, and unmarried and uncoupled and women, right? So
it's about the way that it's regulated.
I don't know. It depends how you read that ooh. Maybe that ooh magidot is, and it reaches an even higher pitch of that. You have to remember, he's living in a world in which already, halachically, because women are not basically maintaining a regime of tuman tahara and caring about touching food or, you know, touching corpses, et cetera, women or men are not caring about that. The only time that women are really engaging with monitoring menstruation in a religious way in his world is in the context of a sexual relationship. So that's probably why it's limited, not because the philosophical point is limited to that. Okay? Now, Jacob Milgram, who I've quoted several times, essentially says what Nigel said before, so I won't go over it, which is what is going on here? What's going on here is that sex is the ultimate life-creating activity. And that the things talked about in Vayikra Tetvav are all shadows of death in one way or another. They are the oozing of fluids that have the potential to create life out of the body in a way that signifies the lack of success to create life. And sex should not be happening in a context of the shadow of death. For Milgram, the entire system of Tuman Tahara and Vayikra is about the culture of life and making the culture of life supreme. And he sees all of the regulations that have to do with Tuman Tahara as clustered around that. That's sort of another pole. And again, we can take the feminist hatchet to this and any number of other things that we've seen and say, why are you calling that a culture of death? Like, I would Dafka call that a culture of life, right? Milgram might say, I don't know, he might be agnostic on that question, but he would say to you, I think he's probably right on this, that yes, in the world of the Torah, though, the aspect that is being emphasized there is that there was a possibility of creating life, and in this case, the menstrual cycle or the kind of dysfunctional discharge from the male member, in the case of the Zav, is creating a context of death that then becomes inappropriate for sex. And if I want to affirm sex as being about, right, it's not quite like Philo about procreation, but about life, it should be restricted from any context that reminds me of death. Okay? Again, I think it adds something to the conversation, even if it doesn't explain all the pieces. Yeah, Sophie.
Can you make that argument?
Right. Well, he would say a lot of it is, right, how he would map it onto the menstruation piece, I'm not sure. But a lot of his thesis for why Vayikra is about life is that there are so many surrounding cultures that do things opposite, right? That is to say, the Torah freaking out about corpse impurity is completely swimming upstream from the Egyptian worship of the dead, right? And actually bringing the dead into the sanctum. By the way, the same thing is true of sex, right? Which is to say, saying that sex renders you tame is a very powerful statement. It's effectively saying there can never be sexuality in the sanctuary, right? Like cultic prostitutes, all of those things, the whole thing of channeling sexuality to get to a higher place, Vayikra is opposed to that. There's no other way to read Vayikra, right? And everything that trickles down from that, right? Be it the mechitza, being it whatever feature of Jewish life that asserts that in certain places of sanctity, we keep sexuality out. By the way, and even with places without a mechitza, there are very strong taboos often on, you know, what way it is or is not appropriate to, like, behave in a shul that often have overtones of whether that sexual space should be going on there. So I think, you know, a lot of it does relate to that surrounding piece, but I'd have to see more about how the life and death thing plays out in those other cultures with respect to this. We're not going to get to page 11. We have 5 minutes. I want to just take you to the end here. I just gave you a site. I'm always skeptical of these things, but I felt obliged to put it on, okay? This is one of these places where it tells you, like, yes, sex during menstruation, fine. But then it does note, for instance, if you're not wearing a condom, for instance, okay, which they weren't, all right? They didn't have latex yet. That, in fact, the potential for infection when having sex during menstruation is higher. Is it possible that among the data that people experienced in the ancient and medieval world and that gave them some degree of fear was that they noticed that people who had sex during menstruation had higher rates of infection? Maybe. I don't know. But I put it out there for you as another thing that can't be totally discounted. Finally, I put in G, apologies, which I both mean by way of sticking it to these passages as actually sort of evading what's really going on, but also to set us up for the fact that apologies, and Tamar Ross writes about this very compellingly in her Expanding the Palace of Torah. She says, you know, you shouldn't scoff too much at apologies, because apologies actually often are the first step in paving the way to creating a new world of thinking about something. She's like, of course, I don't like that someone justifies the bracha, shelo asani isha, thank God for not having made me a woman, by saying women are on a higher spiritual plane. But she says, but you know what? Think about the fact that they feel that they need to live in a culture where you would never say women are on a lower spiritual plane. That itself is a victory. Then we can figure out what we do with shelo asani isha, but don't totally scoff on that at that transition. So in that spirit, I bring you these. One passage from this work, Torah Tamincha, and one from Rabbi Norman Lamb, which talk about, basically, Nidah as about regulating the sex drive and keeping marriage fresh and holy and exciting, etc., etc. Now, why are they apologetics? They're apologetics for two main reasons. One, nothing in the Torah has anything to do with marriage. It's all about a woman who's menstruating. She's married, she's not married. It doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with marriage whatsoever. Two, none of these apologetics account for the fact that suddenly there's absolutely no regulation of sexual activity after menopause or during pregnancy or during other times when simply, you know, basically halakha lets people run wild, right? So what does that say about the apology? And that's why it's not a particularly compelling explanation. But what it does set the stage for, which we're going to see particularly in the last session that we'll do 5 weeks from now, is, because you're all going to be here the whole way through, is the ways in which Nida and the whole structure around it can be used to achieve other ends. That is to say, whether or not Nida is originally about something, we will see again and again the way in which Nidah is applied and the focus that is used for it actually creates different and new religious spaces where it might actually be genuinely about, in a certain kind of application, doing something in the context of marriage. Now, you want to talk that up, you better be prepared for the possibility that after people are either done trying to have kids or having sexual encounters before marriage, that they're not going to do anything about Nidah. Because if you've told them it's all about regulating marriage, they're going to say, well, I don't need that now, right? In which case, you'll want to actually talk about blood, bleeding, menstruation, life, death, etc., and things that go beyond that. But the apologetics are important for sort of seeing the spaces forward. Now, I want to just give 2 minutes here, and then we'll end, on what I called here the gap between our world and theirs. And I want you, now having given you seven things, really six, right, that I hope you will take from tonight at least feeling, I kind of get why there's been some staying power to this, irrespective of whether it still stays with you. That there's been sort of some staying power of a number of different factors that might have been compelling, and we can add some of the things you raised to that list, of why this didn't just disappear with everything else that disappeared in chapter 15, and why it remains with us. To also, before we leave tonight, just to quickly acknowledge the ways in which we legitimately feel a huge gap. It is important to remember that the Torah describes a story in which Rachel is able to convince her father that she cannot stand up and reveal that her idols, his idols are underneath her because she is having her period. No one would ever get away with that claim today, right? Why? Because women are not as weak during their period, as socially debilitated, as visibly covered with blood, and on and on and on. In a way that it behooves us to remember both what that state was and what are some of the things that have moved us to a different place. The model in the image in Eicha to describe Jerusalem as having her tum'ah on the hems of her skirts, right? That image is only compelling if menstruants walk around in society with red stains on their clothing, right? It is a very public, obvious thing. And there's an amazing story in the Gemara where the way this guy, who is described as having merited the world to come, saves a Jewish woman from rape in prison because he takes red paint, actually dregs of wine, and puts it on the hems of her skirts such that the Zoroastrian goons who are about to rape her say, "Oh my God, she's a menstruant." But the only way that works is if menstruants have red stuff all over their clothing. That is to say, they are marked. They are marked off in a way. There's actually a visible marker of a woman who is menstruating. And one of our main gaps with that is that that is not the place, the case today. And it's important to remember some of the basic reasons why it's not the case, which are not to totally be taken for granted. And they include indoor plumbing, entire sections of the drugstore aisle. I'm serious, right? Nutrition that makes women menstruate much more regularly, much more frequently, delayed marriage and childbearing, such that we're, to get back to your point, in a situation where a woman could have experienced her menstrual period hundreds and hundreds of times before even being married, not have it had any kind of ritual significance, etc., and then suddenly, thrown into the context of sex, this is reified as being some kind of big deal. Imagine that being totally different if menarche is not at 11 or 12, but is at 15 or 16. You're getting married off by 17 or 18, and the childbearing cycle starts, and you're not having your period as frequently because nutrition is not as good. It's a lot more of the unknown and the mystery and the what's going on in my body, even if it's normal. That doesn't mean it explains it all and therefore, oh, that's why it makes sense, etc. But you can't begin that conversation without understanding that huge gap. And I brought you other sources that make it very clear that women were cast out into separate spaces in ways that is also simply not true today. And the final piece, just to bring it back to what Rachel raised before, is the last piece that has actually really killed the ability of so many of us to talk about this topic has been actually the evisceration of the other things in Vayikra Tetvav. There are still communities today, primarily in the Haredi world, where a man having a seminal emission requires a response. That is to say, even if he doesn't go to the mikveh, it's assumed, by the way, as it's assumed in many parts of non-Haredi society through a non-ritual frame, that you have to like wash off or take a shower, or do something before you would engage in any kind of sacred act. Right? But the killing off of that, or I might say, the replacement of that by showers, which is another thing we'll talk about, detaches us even further from feeling like No, we're actually genuinely responding to bodily fluxes that require a response, right? When the female aspect of Vayikra Tedvav gets totally isolated in a world that has completely sublimated the male piece, the distance then is going to be even further, because it's also important to remember that in so many of these rabbinic sources, and certainly the biblical sources, it was assumed that that state of seminal emission also demanded some kind of response, even if it didn't add up to the same picture. All right, so we're going to stop here. I would ask you either, please, to bring the sources back with you next time, if you take them home, or, if you're worried you won't do that, to leave them here so we can reuse them. And I look forward to continuing the conversation.